As neurologists, we can learn a lot about a patient just by looking at their eyes. It's the first part of the body that we often identify, but it's one that we're sometimes very quick to discount, instead focusing on the pattern of speech or the power in their arms or legs. Let's not make that mistake today. Today, let's take a moment to consider the abnormalities of pupil size, shape, and reactivity, and refresh our understanding of the neuroanatomy that underlies it. Welcome back to Brainwaves, a podcast about neurology and medicine, and all the fascinating science and history that come with it. This week on the program, the pupil. Just the pupil. What it can really add to our neurologic exam and our understanding of neurologic disease. We'll talk about tonic pupils, the Horner's pathway, light and ear dissociation, and a whole host of other physiologic and pathophysiologic mechanisms that you can pick up on using just a few simple examination techniques. I'm Jim Ziegler. Don't go anywhere. You're probably telling yourself, Jim, there's really not much to say about the pupil.
So when examining the pupils, the key point is to have the patient in a somewhat dimly lit illumination to enable...
It can be dilated and indicate excess sympathetic tone, or it can be constricted and indicate an excess of parasympathetic function. And I'd say, yeah, you're right. Dilation is a sympathetic function, and constriction is a parasympathetic function. So this episode should be quite quick. But there's definitely more to the pupil than the continuous autonomic innervation to this part of the eye.
Body. Now, where do those parasympathetic nerves come from, and what about the whole preganglionic, postganglionic thing?
Let's start off our program with a case. There was a woman that I saw in the trauma ICU just the other day who presented after having collapsed at home. She had fluctuating consciousness and was generally lethargic. In the ED, the 84-year-old woman's vital signs and blood glucose were within normal limits. She was sleepy, but arousable, no lateralizing neurologic deficits. Language was sparse, but she was clearly not aphasic. Generally, she appeared weak, 3 out of 5, power in all extremities, plus or minus. Now, she gets the routine chest x-ray, the urine tox screen, EKG, basic chemistries. All of it comes back practically within normal limits. And then she gets a head CT. Because, well, why not? She has, quote, altered mental status, right? Rule out intracranial hemorrhage, masses, and so on. To be honest, as an aside, I hate that I'm opening with this kind of story. It gives all kind of credence to ED providers and internists to order a head CT for patients who have non-specific altered mental status, having not really thought out the problem or used their exam skills to localize the nervous system lesion. For now, let's just table what the findings of the head CT were. Keep y'all in suspense. Needless to say, our neurology service was consulted. When I met the patient, I found her in bed, sleepy but arousable. She'd wake up and say a few words to me, follow some commands, and when I moved on from the mental status to her cranial nerves, I noticed that her pupils were tiny, almost unreactive. So small that it was hard for me to tell if there was even light and ear dissociation. We'll get to that in a minute. So, bilateral pinpoint pupils. Kind of a trivial detail to notice for some. And she had trouble opening her eyes fully. Bilateral ptosis. Slightly more impressive on the left than the right. The rest of her extraocular movements were intact, her visual fields and acuity were normal, and the rest of her cranial nerves were otherwise working. And as expected, the remainder of her exam was non-lateralizing. So I ran through her list of medications, looking for systemic agents that could cause bilateral pinpoint pupils. Opiates, no. Barbiturates, no. Anticholinergic medications, in contrast, especially inhaled ipratropium nebulizers, scopolamine patches, and tricyclic antidepressants at toxic levels, these can cause dilated pupils, but that wasn't the case for our patient. So, no drugs. At this point, I'm thinking she has excess parasympathetic tone, possibly due to loss of sympathetic function or sympatholysis, something like a bilateral Horner syndrome. This is a convenient diagnosis. It would account for her bilateral ptosis and for her pinpoint minimally reactive pupils. Or she could have tonic pupils, Argyle-Robertson pupils, as you might see in syphilis, diabetes, or potentially other causes of microvascular ischemic disease to the parasympathetic ciliary fibers. Argyle-Robertson pupils exhibit the characteristic reactivity to a target at near meaning they constrict as the patient looks at something coming closer to their eyes, but the eyes don't react to light. More about why that is in a bit. Or the patient could have chronic tonic pupils, which is an idiopathic condition, also seen when there's light near dissociation. Initially, the tonic pupil will appear larger due to damage of the ciliary ganglion. However, over time, the pupil will become small and, well, tonic, unreactive to light. It should continue to react to a target at near, but honestly, sometimes with such myotic pupils, especially with aging, it can be hard to see further pupillary constriction. And that's really the extent of your differential diagnosis. She has bilateral Horner's, left worse than right, or chronic tonic pupils, which includes Argyle-Robertson pupils. Knowing this, let's now talk about the results of the head CT. And based on our differential, an intracranial explanation for her pupil abnormalities would be at the bottom of your differential diagnosis. You should not expect a brain problem with chronic tonic pupils, which by definition are idiopathic, or with Argyle-Robertson pupils, which some might argue is due to a chronic ciliary ganglionopathy, only for a first-order neuron lesion in a bilateral Horner's, with either hypothalamic or brainstem involvement, might you find something abnormal on the head CT. But she also has lethargy, so technically an intracranial lesion is plausible. The interesting thing was, there was an abnormality on the head CT, a very unusual abnormality. The patient had bilateral thalamic hypodensities with edema and a left-sided paraphalcine longitudinal intraparenchymal hemorrhage that was extending into the subdural and subarachnoid space, curving around the left hemisphere, likely a diffuse midline lesion affecting both thalami and the left-sided periventricular white matter with the hemorrhagic component. We'll skip the differential diagnosis of such a lesion for the time being. I'm probably not explaining it well enough to help you narrow your own differential. But the fact of the matter was, she had a midline bithalamic mass with edema and with compression of the diencephalon. It turned out something was compressing her hypothalamus, and it was compressing that first-order neuron of the Horner's pathway that goes to the eye and the face. A perfect explanation for her symptoms of bilateral meiosis and left more than right-sided lid ptosis. On rounds, as we discussed this patient, although we emphasize the importance of lesion localization, I will be honest, much of our discussion centered around the cause of her neuroimaging abnormality. But for the purposes of this episode, let's talk about the usefulness of the pupillary examination. Before we get too deep into a discussion of the pathophysiology of the pupil, it's worth refreshing our memory of the neuroanatomy.
I'm just going to test your pupils, if that's okay.
Yep. Normal constriction of the pupil, which happens with bright light, is a consequence of cholinergic parasympathetic signaling of the pupillary sphincter.
I'm just going to come up close with a light, doesn't it?
And if you're able to see the opposite eye at the same time, there'll be a consensual response.
And this is an important caveat, or normal constriction of the pupil can be due to fixation of a target at near. Physiologic pupillary dilation, in contrast, is due to sympathetic catecholaminergic signaling of the pupillary dilator. When thinking about abnormalities of these pupillary responses, as in all neurologic localization, you should walk your way through each of these pathways involved in pupil function in order not to miss a possible source of the lesion. With the response to brighter ambient light, photoreceptors in the retina signal information back via the optic nerve across the chiasm and towards the lateral geniculate nucleus of the thalamus, but first they branch off to the pretectal olivary nucleus. And from this nucleus, fibers extend ventrally to the ipsilateral and contralateral Edinger-Westphal nucleus, which you might remember is the parasympathetic arm of the third nerve nucleus in the dorsal midbrain. From here, parasympathetic fibers exit the midbrain, and they synapse on the ciliary ganglion, just posterior to the globe, and from the ciliary ganglion to the pupillary sphincter. This pathway controls pupillary constriction. Pupillary dilation, or mydriasis, is subserved by the sympathetic nervous system, with the first-order neuron originating in the hypothalamus, as was damaged in our patient, specifically the paraventricular and the arcuate nuclei. Fibers from these hypothalamic centers descend in the lateral brainstem, and they eventually reach the lateral spinal cord between C8 and T2 to synapse on the ciliospinal nucleus of Budge. This second-order sympathetic neuron projects axons out towards the apex of the lung and the subclavian artery, ascending via the common carotid arteries, ultimately synapsing on the superior cervical sympathetic ganglion, the third-order neuron of the Horner's pathway. The superior cervical ganglion abuts the carotid bulb, which is why it's not uncommon to experience ipsilateral Horner syndrome with carotid dissection. Axons from the superior cervical ganglion then innervate the pupillary dilator, causing the pupil to widen in the absence of light, and in other circumstances such as stress, seizures, migraines, and in the presence of exogenous catecholamines or certain stimulants. But these axons from the superior cervical ganglion also innervate the sweat glands of the ipsilateral face and also the superior and inferior tarsal muscles, which are responsible for opening the eyes. Along with the levator palpebrae superioris, which is innervated by the third nerve, denervation of the superior tarsal muscle can cause ptosis of the eyelid, which is why you get a mild ptosis with the Horner's. The ptosis due to a third nerve palsy, by comparison, tends to be much more severe. Next, let's move on to why the pupils constrict with a target at near, which is interesting. The near triad consists of meiosis, convergence, and accommodation, which describes the manner in which the lens relaxes in order to maintain focus on a target at near. For the most part, all you need to know as a neurologist is that much of this signaling originates in the cortex, and it's mediated by several midbrain nuclei before reaching the Edinger-Westphal nucleus, which is responsible for triggering meiosis, and then the medial rectus subnuclei of the oculomotor nucleus gets recruited to assist in convergence of the eyes, bringing them inward. Interestingly, the near response results in a much more powerful signal when compared to the light response, because of a higher density of ciliary ganglionic fibers conveying the signal in response to a target that approaches the eyes at a ratio of 30 to 1. It turns out that 97% of the ciliary ganglionic fibers mediate the response to a near target. Therefore, with any damage to these ciliary fibers or to the ciliary ganglion, you're more likely to dampen the response to light and preserve the constrictive response to a near target. When there's failure of those 3% of the ciliary fibers responsible for mediating the light response, but you have a preserved response to targets at near, it's called light-near dissociation. And light-near dissociation can localize to one of three major regions within the central nervous system: the dorsal midbrain, the ciliary ganglion, which can cause the tonic pupil, or arguably an Argyle-Robertson pupil, and lastly, an amaurotic pupil. With a dorsal midbrain syndrome, or Paranaud syndrome, the pupils are typically mid-sized, and in addition to the light-near dissociation, there's an impaired upgaze as you're compressing the vertical movement centers, and an associated convergence, retraction, nystagmus. Often, Paranaud's is attributed to hydrocephalus, or a pineal region tumor. And sometimes, with the pretectal syndrome, you may also find a fourth nerve palsy, or ataxia. The second cause of light-near dissociation, with tonic pupils, this is kind of an interesting cause of a pupillary abnormality. Tonic pupils can happen at any age, with the median age of onset being 32, and it's more common in women. In the acute and the subacute setting, the tonic pupil is mydriatic, but after several months, the pupil becomes small as reinnervation occurs following pathologic upregulation of the acetylcholine receptors, causing an excess in parasympathetic tone. On the slit lamp exam, you might find sectoral paralysis, with some parts of the pupil responding better to light than others, causing the pupil to appear irregular in shape. In 10% of patients, the other eye may ultimately become involved at some point. Argyle-Robertson pupils, as we see classically in tertiary syphilis and diabetes, has a highly debated mechanism. But irrespective of the true source of the lesion with Argyle-Robertson pupils, all experts agree that the majority of the fibers of the ciliary ganglion, again, that parasympathetic nucleus that controls the constriction of pupils in response to light and a near target, almost 97% of these fibers control the shape of the lens and constrict the pupil to the target at near. The remaining 3% of fibers are responsible for that light response, like we discussed. And finally, the third major cause of light-near dissociation is the amaurotic pupil, meaning a deafferented pupil. The eye is completely blind because of retinal or some kind of optic nerve pathology. So naturally, there's no transmissible light input via the optic nerve, and yet the eye can still constrict appropriately to a near response. Even in patients with bilateral blindness, they can show a light-near dissociation, and their pupils can constrict to a near response if you ask them to place their thumb in front of their nose, and by using their proprioceptive clues, they can try to look at it. In the next half of the talk, let's establish a framework for evaluating anisocoria. More often than not, in the hospital, I get consulted for an abnormally large pupil. However, you should not go into anisocoria, or unequal pupil size, assuming that the large pupil is the pathologic pupil. it could be the smaller pupil. So you need to test each pupil independently for their shape and their size in ambient light, in bright light, and in the dark. If the large pupil does not constrict appropriately to a light stimulus, then yeah, that one is probably the problematic pupil. If the small pupil does not dilate appropriately to darkness, then it's the small pupil that's pathologic. In thinking broadly, the most common cause of anisocoria is physiologic anisocoria, about 15 to 30% of the cases, in which both pupils react appropriately to light and dark, but one pupil is slightly larger than the other, often not in excess of a millimeter or so. Sometimes the pupillary inequality can be just a bit exaggerated in the dark, but it should not become more impressive in the light. At that point, you should be thinking that there's a pathologic constrictive process of the larger pupil. So what causes an impaired constrictive response, or an abnormally dilated pupil that will not react to light? Your first step is to determine if a third nerve palsy is present. Is there ptosis of the levator palpebrae? Is the eye deviating downward and outward? As you know, compressive third nerve palsies, as in the case of a PCOM aneurysm or a tumor, typically there's damage to the parasympathetic fibers that surround the third nerve before there's damage to the deeper fibers of the third nerve responsible for oculomotor movements. If there's no evidence of a third nerve palsy, and no clinical history or imaging that's suggestive of an intracranial lesion or an aneurysm, your next step would be to evaluate for a tonic pupil. Like I mentioned before, the tonic pupil starts off dilated, and over 1 to 2 months it becomes smaller. The tonic pupil should exhibit light near dissociation, and it should respond to the instillation of a cholinergic agonist like pilocarpine. If there's no response to high doses of pilocarpine, then the dilation is pharmacologic, as in the case of ipratropium nebulizers, a scopolamine patch, or a sympathomimetic. In addition to these other causes, an abnormally dilated pupil may also be the consequence of seizures, although this is typically bilateral, or it could be the consequence of certain headache syndromes, especially migraines. Next, let's say the constrictive response to light is normal, and the pathologic pupil is the one that does not dilate appropriately in response to dark. This often indicates sympathetic failure. Usually, you might notice mild ptosis due to weakness of those superior and inferior tarsal muscles, Müller's muscles, and as we discussed briefly with the opening case, Horner syndrome can result from an injury to any of three neurons in the sympathetic pathway that originates in the hypothalamus. Damage to the first-order neuron, or its axons, as they descend through the lateral pons and medulla, can be associated with certain long-track signs, such as ataxia that's ipsilateral to the affected eye, or ipsilateral anhidrosis of the face and the hemibody, which is an important differentiator because only a first-order neuron Horner's can cause anhidrosis of the body. The patient may also have contralateral hemisensory loss to pain and temperature, and sometimes an ipsilateral 6th or 7th nerve palsy, which you'd recognize as the Wallenberg syndrome from, say, a lateral medullary infarction or from demyelination. Moving on, injury to the second order neuron at the ciliospinal nucleus of Budge in the lateral spinal cord between C8 and T2, or damage to its axons as they exit over the lung and ascend up the carotid, a lesion here can also cause ipsilateral meiosis and ptosis. Unlike the first order neuron Horner's, lesions at this level will only cause ipsilateral facial anhidrosis, not anhidrosis of the hemibody. You'll want to rule out traumatic injury, proximal carotid dissection, Pancoast tumor of the lung apex, or sometimes a transverse myelitis. And finally, a lesion to the third order neuron resulting in Horner's will cause ipsilateral ptosis and meiosis, but it will not cause hemifacial anhidrosis. According to Liu, Volpe, and Galetta, there should be some anhidrosis of the medial forehead and the lateral nose, but the remaining half of the face may sweat normally, as there is redundant sympathetic innervation. While you can even test for regions of facial anhidrosis with alizarin powder, which turns purple in the presence of sweat, this is purely an academic exercise. Clinically, you'd be more than justified to image the carotid arteries and the soft tissue in the neck and follow up with the cervical spine MRI in the presence of other long-track signs. Quickly, I want to acknowledge congenital Horner syndrome because it's kind of interesting. These infants often have heterochromia of the iris, with the iris on the side of the Horner's typically being lighter in color. And this is because that iris melanocytes require oculosympathetic input during development. Often a congenital Horner's is idiopathic, but an occult neuroblastoma in the soft tissues of the neck or the lung apex ought to be ruled out with imaging. And in the last chapter of this week's episode, I want to touch on the relative afferent pupillary defect. In an APD, as I'm sure you know, the pathologic pupil constricts seemingly appropriately in response to a light stimulus and to a target at near. However, following light stimulation of the healthy eye on the other side, swinging the flashlight to the affected pupil will cause a paradoxical dilation.
To determine whether there's an afferent pupillary defect, it's important to swing the light quickly from eye to eye to see whether the pupils maintain their same constriction.
Take care to illuminate each pupil for the same amount of time, as if you spend more time with the light on one pupil compared to the other. You can create an artifactual RAPD due to uneven bleaching of the photoreceptors.
Importantly, this is still a constrictive response to light when compared to the ambient light or to darkness. It's just that the response is less robust than the affected eye due to an optic nerve problem. And you might also notice that the healthy eye dilates somewhat in response to the light swinging over to the pathologic eye. Now, we all know that this is a consequence of an optic neuropathy or some severe retinal process, and it manifests with blurred vision or loss of monocular vision and red desaturation, so a lesion that's anterior to the optic chiasm. But one point to make here, because this episode is all about the subtleties of pupil pathology, is that in rare instances, an afferent pupillary defect may be inappropriately called in the setting of an anisocoria because the small pupil is too small to allow in sufficient light to the retina. This eye may therefore fail to dilate appropriately to a swinging flashlight. Alternatively, an APD may also be due to a chiasmal or a pre-chiasmal process. A lesion of the optic tract can cause a contralateral APD. A couple of reasons for this. First, recall that the ratio of crossed to uncrossed fibers from the optic nerve is 53 to 47, so there are more fibers that cross to the contralateral optic tract. Second, there's a greater density of nasal retinal ganglion cells than temporal retinal ganglion cells. This is because each eye should be able to see more of the temporal visual field, about 60 to 70% larger of a field than that eye's nasal field. So more visual input from the right eye, for example, comes from the right visual field, and it will ultimately cross at the chiasm. Therefore, if the left side of the optic tract were to be injured, say from a tumor or from demyelination, the pupils will respond as if the right eye were receiving ever so slightly less input than the left eye, producing an APD. Now, I'll say that's a bit complicated if you're hearing it for the first time, so you may want to click the rewind button and play it back, but it's pretty neat. That's basically it for our talk on the pupil today. Hopefully not too dense, and hopefully you were able to take something away from this review when you return to the clinic or to rounds. While we ended up talking for 20 to 25 minutes, this was only a brief overview of pupillary abnormalities, and obviously we didn't have enough time to cover all the unusual pupillary changes, including causes of abnormally shaped pupils, ocular trauma or iritis, angle closure glaucoma, the slit lamp exam, or more in-depth discussion of pharmacologic testing. So if you're interested in reading up on these, check out the textbook by Grant Liu, Nicholas Volpe, and Steve Galletta on neuro-ophthalmology, which we reference in this week's show notes. There are a few great chapters all about the pupil and on the pharmacologic testing of pupil function. If your hospital program has a copy of this textbook, I'd highly recommend that you check it out. This week's episode of the Brainwaves Podcast was produced by myself, Chip Ziegler. Our show is produced at a Studio 3 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, with music this week courtesy of Chris Haugen, Daniel Birch, and Lee Rosevere. Sound effects by Mike Koenig and Daniel Simeon. For more information about what's discussed on the show, as always, you can take a look at our show notes for the references to the highest yield literature on the topics, and follow us on Twitter at Brainwaves Audio. I'm Jim Ziegler. Talk to you soon. And as promised on Twitter, here are a couple of dad jokes, courtesy of Dr. Olga Tone, one of the producers of our show.
Why did the cross-eyed teacher quit her job?
Why?
She couldn't control her pupils. What does it take to become noticed as a famous eyewear designer?
Tell me.
A focus on fashion and an eye for style.
What's a neuro-ophthalmologist's favorite movie?
I don't know.
I Know What You Did Last Summer. Or their favorite poem. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
A bone doctor and an eye doctor are telling each other jokes. The bone doctor jokes were humorous, but the eye doctor's jokes were cornier.
I used that one earlier. That was good. Okay, I got it. You ready? What did the larger pupil say to the smaller pupil?
What?
I'm dilated to see you.